You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. I represent the Political Center. I am joined on the left by State Senator Jim DeBacchus.
Good morning, Natalie.
Welcome to this balmy 50-degree day, Jim.
It is so cool out there.
And by State Representative and Speaker-elect Greg Hughes. Welcome, Greg.
Good morning, Natalie.
Need I say that you represent the political right?
Absolutely.
We have so much going on right now, and in the second segment, we are going to talk about the new revenue numbers and the state budget. Some interesting news.
We're rich!
It's going to be
We're just soaking in
time
cash.
For a tax cut, Greg.
Well, Natalie, hold on.
Okay.
I have to use my public radio voice. Now that I'm Speaker-elect, I have to be much more serious. This is my serious voice.
He's in a suit and tie again today.
Looks like Howard Stevenson.
Yeah. So, no, here's the deal.
Good.
We have great revenues that have arrived. This is what you have to be careful about. That we told taxpayers this is what the cost is to run state government. Economy does well, people pay their taxes, and lo and behold, more dollars arrive than what we anticipated would come in to pay the bills. That's called a surplus. What people like to do and what politicians love to do, Jim, is spend every dime of that new money that comes in because we have all these needs and we have all these wants. And I'm not belittling needs and things out there, but what happens is it's a roller coaster. So you go and on this spending spree and you say it's surplus dollars. We're going to get every one of them ongoing. We're going to spend because we have it. It's burning a hole in our pocket. And then guess what happens? The economy slows down as it always does. Mm-hmm. It's a cyclical process. And then the cuts begin. And then we start to pull back. And what we end up doing in the long run is yo-yoing benefits or services to our constituents. The sustainability is less. So what we've looked at this year is, look, we have a trend line of growth and we need to – and there's lots to do. But where we see revenues arrive that are kind of a bubble or above that trend line, let's pause. Let's not look at that as necessarily ongoing. Let's look at some one-time costs. Let's look at bolstering our rainy day funds. Let's just be – cautiously optimistic. Jim, will you join me in being cautiously optimistic?
Well, and Jim, let's put some numbers to it. So about $360 million of new money. About 100.
But new money means this is above what our really good analysts figured we would bring in. So that means that's what new money means.
No,
right?
I think 360 means 360 million has come from the new growth, and so it's above the base budget. So we got 360 million beyond base to go spend.
So
the
ones that
are beyond the analysts are the one-time monies, where we have 112 million of one-time in 2014.
So this means 360 above where we were last year.
In a way to think of it,
yep.
it's new
okay.
money you can spend.
So
then
it's even above. The normal, they trend growth.
Right.
This is even above that.
Then you have $112 million in one time from 2014 that was left over. That fiscal year has ended.
That means money that we left in the bank last year.
More came in than we thought. And then you have $148 million of one time projected for 2015.
What does that mean, one time projected?
So it's like this. It's like if you have a set dollar, it's your Christmas bonus. It's one time, here you go. The salary increase is ongoing. It's money that you expect to come now, tomorrow, next year, and forever.
The way I teach my students, Jim, if you want to come take my class, I tell them, if you're paying school teachers, it's got to be ongoing. If
Correct.
You're paying police officers, ongoing. If you're buying buildings one time, I know you know that.
You're building a school.
Yeah.
All right. So it's like $620 million more than we thought.
$620 million to spend or give back.
There's a lot of money. Look, again, people are asking right now a lot about tax increases. Are you going to raise taxes? Well, this is the difficult narrative. We have more dollars. Taxpayers have sent in more dollars than what it took to run government. We'd like to spend all that and raise your taxes as well. What do you say? I think that's hard.
Greg, here's my question for you, though.
Yes.
Why don't we, as leaders of this state, and I'm just saying you two as elected officials, those of us that vote and are very engaged publicly, why don't we see this as an opportunity? Why don't we see this money as an opportunity to go take care of investments that are desperately needed?
I'll tell you, I think I'm taking Jim's time here. I haven't heard him yell at me yet. But I don't disagree with that. But what we don't want to do is under the banner of let's fulfill some unmet needs, put money ongoing that really won't be sustainable. And we'll find ourselves pulling back or retracting as the economy slows down. So
Jim,
we have to make it sustainable.
Is governed by fear. we can't spend – we can't invest
–
Since when is prudence fear?
We can't invest more in our education system, which is our future prosperity, because we might have something in the future – that would make us have to make hard decisions?
Boy, I got nothing to say.
Yeah, it's not. No. But let me clarify. I was waiting for you just to yell at me, but you didn't do it again. I must be catching you on a good day.
He's feeling rather conservative.
There's inherently
today.
More, Natalie. There's inherently more. We have population. We have a 10,000 new students coming into the system than have graduated last year. We've got enrollment growth. We know we're going to look at that weighted pupil unit that we fund for students in our public schools. We'll be increasing. There will be more. It's just how much would you like to budget that you think will be sustainable and that we won't be cutting at a later date. So I think that we see more, but we don't want to be drunken sailors here.
Jim, it's my responsibility to make sure you speak out. I've never had to pull it out from you, so come on.
Imagine Utah is a family. And for years now, we've been saying all you can eat is potatoes. You can boil them. You can fry them. You can mash them on a good day because we can afford butter. But potatoes are all you have. And all the states around us are having good meals. Now suddenly we get a lot of money, and the state is saying, no, you stick with the potatoes because you never know. We may not have money for butter tomorrow. And I'm saying when it comes to our Utah school children, the only reason we have this windfall is because we have cheated our school children for so long. We've been 50th in education funding. We've had the biggest classrooms in the country. Our high school graduation rate is declining. We have so shortchanged our higher ed. We have taken state funding dramatically away and forced our kids into borrowing money that now suddenly when we get this money, it isn't like, oh, wow, this is new money that we should shove back. This is money that we have cheated our youngsters from for a generation. And giving them what they deserve is not going on a windfall.
We got California. Just embraced this narrative back in the last boom. They not only did they spend every dime of surplus, they even bonded on top of that. When the crash came, they took every school nurse out of every elementary school. Any teacher that had been on the job for less than 2 years got the pink slip and was let go. Again, we've got to look beyond just this fiscal year.
Great.
And so it's not because we don't care or that we're callous. It's how do you make these the growth that's required sustainable?
I love your fiscal prudence.
I want to
just make the point that it's been my experience that often in government you can pay now or pay a lot more later.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm observing very troubling warning signs in education, where we are dead last among peer states, where completion rates are falling, where women and their graduation rates we've lost our edge, where our funding commitment has fallen from 8th to 32nd. So these are warning signs. And you know what? All those warning signs you don't see in the economy right now. You see them 10, 15 years from now. And I love that you are going to leave the state better than you found it as a leader. But we have got to view this money as an opportunity. That's the voice from the middle. This is an opportunity to go invest in our future.
But join me in finding where we are taxing these silos of dollars. And let's find smart ways. I mean, we've got a lot of discussion coming on transportation funding. And it's been quoted. I've said now we still have this caucus meeting to have and really develop a transportation policy. But I don't see a tax increase necessarily on the horizon. However, I will tell you, this gas tax is a dinosaur. It is losing money. Forget about raising money. You are losing money every single year. There is ways to look at that tax structure and look at reform. I would argue that as well in public education, let's just not look for the quick fix. Let's just politicians put bigger numbers at the bottom of the line. Let's look at how we're taxing people and see if there's a smarter way or a better way or a more efficient way to do it.
You heard it here on
Greg's
both sides
right on
of the
transportation.
Aisle.
I've heard him talk about that gas tax. He's absolutely right. So there you go. He's occasionally.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. In our next segment, we'll talk about the governor and count my vote.
This is Jim DeBacchus on the left.
And Greg Hughes on the right.
And Natalie Gochner in the political center. And this is Both Sides of the Aisle. We're going to talk right now about Count My Vote, Governor Herbert, the Republican Party, and what's going on. And I don't know. There's a lot of ways to set this up. But here's how I would set it up. Count My Vote is an initiative to improve voter participation in our state. We wanted to do that by having the ability to get on the ballot without going through a caucus system, felt it was outdated, required a specific time, a specific place. Nothing in society requires that anymore. There's a better way. Of course, Count My Vote got all the way to 115,000 signatures. In the last legislative session, it was pretty clear that Count My Vote was going to have this on the ballot. The public likes it, so there was room for a compromise. The legislature joined with Count My Vote and passed SB 54. Was passed by a Republican legislature. It was signed by a Republican governor. And now the Republican Party is suing. And it will be defended by a Republican attorney general. And I'm sitting here going, I'm a registered Republican. I'm like, what is my party doing? I don't get this.
I know. Do you want me to tell you?
Well, so, that's my setup. Is that an okay setup, Jim? Does that cover the
so little? I just want to say that the background behind this is you had a very conservative 18-year U.S. senator who was an establishment baby in the U.S. Senate, and this upstart Tea Party guy.
I knew he was going to somehow get Mike Lee into this.
No, but this is actually the background of why this really happened. The establishment Republicans were furious that Mike Lee beat Bob Bennett. It was the final straw that broke the camel's back, and they said, that's it. We're going to strangle this caucus thing for once and for all, and we're going to open this up because in an open primary, in a voting primary, the Tea Party and the more fringy parts of the Republican Party won't have the same kind of power. I mean, I really honestly think that that's what all this came that's why
this
all this came about.
This is a schism in the Republican Party.
Well, it is kind of.
I think it was an overreaction, and I'll tell you why. That our 2010 was no different than the country's 2010. Mm-hmm. You saw a lot of conservative, maybe establishment or Republican or establishment senators who in primaries lost as incumbents during that year. This is during the bailout for the auto industry and for banks. And there was this organic Tea Party that rose up, and people that these weren't your familiars. These were people that were truly frightened by what they were seeing because there were some drastic things happening around the country. So there was a primary in that race. That's what I think people often leave out is that the delegates in that convention did not pick a nominee for the U.S. Senate. They brought two people to a primary race, and there was a primary election, and one was more conservative than the other. If the theory were to hold true, then once you got to that primary, then certainly the more moderate or the less conservative candidate would have prevailed. Tim Bridgewater was still conservative, but not seen maybe as right of center as Mike Lee. Mike Lee beat Tim Bridgewater. The more conservative candidate won in a primary. And so if that's the reason,
can I just ask you this,
Greg,
on that point, do you think
I worry about that.
You think I said it last week on this program. Why do we have to delegate our vote? Why don't we just vote? Why don't people get the opportunity to vote for Bob Bennett if they want to?
And I think that most of those primaries or most of those convention battles end up in a primary, or many do. This is what if I could just be king for a day. This is what I would do. If a political party is too insular,
if I could be speaker for the day. Here's what I'd do.
If a political party is too insular and it decides we're going to have conventions and then we're going to close our primaries and the public at large feels disenfranchised, guess what they do?
They
have
vote.
Jim DeBacchus on the other side on the left say, this party doesn't care about you. This is a closed-door deal. Vote Democrat. And as the elections sway, parties respond. But what we did is we said we're not going to let this this pendulum swing, because I'll tell you, I've been involved in campaigns. I've watched this political process for decades. And I will tell you, the way that Republicans have nominated their candidates and the likelihood of primaries have never been constant throughout. They have changed over time. Mm-hmm. And I think if there had been a reaction at the ballot box and Republicans felt that they were seeing less success, certainly that would change. But we put a bill out there, and I'll come clean. I voted for the compromise because I was worried about losing the caucus convention cycle wholly. It was an appropriate compromise. But I'll tell you, if the party or even the Democrat Party in its convention that said when they last met they didn't like it either, if they want to say, wait a minute, can you take a political party and dictate how it nominates candidates or puts them on the ballot, nominates and puts on the ballot from the legislative side? Ask away. It doesn't. I'm not threatened by that.
Except there's one little problem with that, and I keep hearing James Evans, my good friend, say, who is the legislature to take this private corporation of a party that we have? How many other private corporations go to the legislature to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars? It is the state taxpayers that pay for those primaries.
Sure.
So suddenly it isn't like an isolated third party that has no dog in the fight. The taxpayers are paying for that. So if James doesn't want any taxpayers' money, then fine, let him go out and run the thing. But as long as the taxpayers are paying for it, you can't have it both ways here.
And that's been the rationale, and that's why, frankly, people believe that it was constitutional, is because there is a state nexus that the state pays for the elections of these primaries.
Well, so let's just be honest. Why this popped in this week? It popped because Governor Herbert has had a communication misstep, in my judgment. I don't know what else to say. I mean, this is a governor who signed the bill. He said, I'm a product of the caucus system. I believe in the caucus system. But, you know, the public clearly wants something here, and the caucus system was going to go away. I mean, Count My Vote would have been successful. Otherwise, the compromise would never happen.
Oh, I agree.
And so the governor has two things happen. He has a trusted political advisor go to the party and say, hey, you know, the governor supports your lawsuit. I mean, I think that's what I read was said. And then within days, the spokesperson is putting out word that, no, the governor, you know, signed the compromise because he believed in it. And, you know, this happens in a governor's
office.
They're
suing the governor, and the governor says, hey, I want to be sued. Sue me.
But you've heard me just say the same thing. I'm saying if a party wants to ask for clarification or challenge the work that the legislature has done, do it. I'm not out there saber-rattling with, but I'm saying, look, go ask.
I guess we need to move on to other things. But why did Count My Vote – if they had the votes, why did they do this? I mean, those are smart political people. They should have known that there could have been a backstabber here somewhere. Why didn't they say, no, Bramble, do whatever you're going to do. We're going on the ballot, and then there's nothing you can do about it. Why?
Because it was more fighting, and it would have required running a campaign, and it would have been quite expensive, and we had reached a better solution. We preserved the best of the caucus system, gave an alternative route to the ballot, and opened the primary, which we didn't get with our initiative.
My kudos to the Democrat Party who withdrawn from this discussion. I still believe that Democrat delegates don't like that this process being changed, and I think they voted as much. But Democrats were smart as a party to remove themselves and create a narrative where Republicans are just fighting with each other.
Yeah.
The sad part about that is we enjoy Pew Institute's one of the best-run states in the country. We have a AAA bond rating. I think we do things very well, and I think there's always challenges. But I don't think this Republican Party has betrayed the public, and yet this is only a fight amongst Republicans. And I think hats off to the Democrats for getting out of the way. I still think if you asked them and you cornered them and no one was listening, they'd say they have an issue with this as well. But the circular firing squad has officially come together here, yeah. And I regret that.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. I'm joined by Jim DeBacchus on the left and Greg Hughes on the right. I just have one last thing to say on that. What was happening with the Republican Party? I must have gotten 12 emails to say the governor supports this, and it was like boom, 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 and I'm like,
I read like five of them thinking maybe there's a different message in here because it keeps coming.
Yeah. So we had a few communication problems. Jim,
you're off the list. I don't know why.
Given what the governor had to deal with, I mean, that's a tough communications issue. Let's talk about something a little bit more interesting, maybe a little bit more trivial, but pieces of the Hoberman Arch stolen from a Salt Lake City lot. This is an arch at metal ceremony. I mean, a billion people a night got to see this. What's going on?
It was where we handed out the medals, that unbelievably beautiful, like a stage almost, and then it was up by the Rice-Eccles Stadium for many years.
Scrap.
It got stolen, and they're melting it down. It just breaks my heart.
So I hope
did it end up in a metal scrap yard anyway?
I you know, in my business, I've had property destroyed for scrap metal as well. It's frustrating, believe me.
Well, and I'm hoping that that arch finds its way to our newly rebuilt Salt Lake International Airport. I'll just go on the record that would be a very good place to put it.
With some security, huh?
So we go from the Hoberman Arch now to prison relocation. I don't know if you guys serve. I know Greg does because it's his area, Draper, but Oh, Greg, what do we have to do to keep this prison out of a neighborhood? That's as a taxpayer, that's what I want to see.
I think that will happen, Natalie. Here's what we have. The state of Utah could have surplus land, purchased land, relocated this prison under existing statute with very little public process. Mm-hmm. It would have been a procurement or an RFP. It could have been as little as 120 days.
Mm-hmm.
And we are now 3 years into public hearings and into this process. And so I think that vetting these potential sites, I made a motion in there to consider population growth, the master plan for the political jurisdictions in which they're considering. Would the state be at odds with itself in terms of GOED, Governor's Office of Economic Development, EDCU, Economic Development Corporation of Utah? Are they trying to attract businesses and the state is looking at a prison site maybe in the same place that you've got
it? It's nuts.
So we have to scrutinize
especially,
those things, and I think we will.
Especially in a state that has as much, let's just call it, undevelopable land as we have.
Yes. Now here's the key. When we talk proximity,
it's all real high value recreation land, and a lot of it is. But there are places for prisons in Utah.
I know you want to keep it all, and you want to keep people off of it and keep it pristine and pretty. Here's the deal. It's the volunteer. You have to have an employment base, so you need a population that can access by way of employment. But also the 1,200 volunteers that go into this facility
and families.
Yeah, there is such a human element to what's going on here. Most of these people are coming out of jail.
I look at
I-80. So you want those volunteers being there.
I look at I-80 heading into Tooele County,
yes,
and it is just underutilized. There's a lot of excess capacity on
I-80. Yeah, Mad Max called. They want their movie set back. Okay, have you seen it out there?
You can put anything out there. You know what thrills me actually about – I never believed I could come to this, being thrilled by the – it is not the location move. That is the agony. But the ecstasy part of this is
agony and ecstasy.
The Pew Charitable has brought to the table an astonishing amount of information about resentencing, about a 30 or 40 year plan on how we've been sentencing people and how we ought not to be, bringing real important data to the table that is going to help our state really lock up the people that need to be locked up, but change the whole system. That part has really been a tremendous part of this moving the prison. Turns out nobody wants it, but I think the most vulnerable about wanting it is Tooele County. And that ought to be an element, the fact that does the home county, does the home city want it? And I, so far, kind of nobody does, but Tooele seems less vehement, and their economic position is such that it might be the
place. I was working in Bengeter's office when they decided the Gunnison prison location. And I have seen where there's competition for prison sites, and there was competition for that.
Well, Gunnison would like this one. Problem is we don't have the employment base or volunteer base to move it to a place that remote. But I'll tell you this. We fought actually for these public hearings. We wanted this kind of
input. So it's playing out the way you wanted it.
This is what we wanted. We wanted a very transparent process. And what you've seen over 3 years are critics originally.
Sure beats Obamacare.
That have come around. There's a lot of critics that said, hey, wait a minute, why are you doing it? But they've come around, and that's a good thing.
Gentlemen, it's time to go to our gripes. Jim, do you have a gripe ready to go?
I've got a gripe ready to go.
Is it going to include Kiss My Beehive? You did that in your gripe last week. I thought it was eloquent.
No. If we knew right now who the 40 people are going to be that are going to die, and just like an actuarial table, we know how many people are going to die as a result of raising that speed limit up to 70. If we could give you those names, would you change your mind now? Would those families change the rest of our minds? Because raising the speed limit to 70 is going to kill people sure as shooting in our state.
Amen. Oh, wow. I had that written down as a potential gripe, but thankfully I've got a plan B. Mr. Greg.
Jeez. Let me just say this. We have a regulatory climate in the state of Utah that allows 15-year-olds to get a learner's permit and drive vehicles. My 15-year-old daughter, I was pressured by this regulatory climate to allow my daughter behind the wheel of my wife's automobile, And in an empty parking lot with a lamppost fortified by concrete, my daughter ran my vehicle right into it. Okay? I said to her, this is going to cost a lot of money. She said, trade it in. I said, what do you actually think happens when you trade it in? What does that even mean? Anyway, that's my rant. I am against 15-year-olds driving my car unprepared.
If listeners want to see the picture of the hurt car, just go to Greg's Facebook page.
There it is.
My quick gripe, where's the snow? I am ready for snow. We need it. Quit the balmy temperatures. Get the ski industry going. That's my gripe. I'm Natalie Gochner. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. It's produced by Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.